Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man.
That would be your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, just one of the legendary superheroes created by Marvel Comics writer Stan Lee. The 95-year-old creative tour de force died on Monday, but leaves behind a universe of characters, the Marvel Universe, who've jumped, flown, crawled, and smashed their way from page to screen, making Marvel a multi-billion dollar enterprise. Think Thor, the Hulk, Black Panther, and more. And like his characters, Stan Lee was larger than life and often polarizing, leaving behind a legacy as complicated as the Marvel Universe itself. So this hour on Point, we'll remember Stan Lee, superhero of Marvel Comics. And you can join us. How are you remembering Stan Lee? What's your favorite Marvel character? What do Spider-Man, Black Panther, Thor, and so many more mean to you? And by the way, is the Marvel of today, with its entire Hollywood-dominating blockbuster universe, does it have the same draw, the charm, as the Marvel of old? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us first today from New York is Abraham Reisman. He's staff writer for New York Magazine and Vulture.com, and he wrote, "It's Stan Lee's Universe and Stan Lee Gave More Than He Took." We've got links to those articles at onpointradio.org. Abraham Reisman, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
All right, so first of all, if you could describe what Stan Lee's own superpower was, what would it be?
Well, where do you even begin? He was an ideas man. He was about as creative as it gets, especially in his prime. But I would say his greatest superpower was being a salesman. There was no one better at marketing the American comic book and American superhero fiction than he was. And he remained a cheerleader for that medium and that genre right up until the end. And nobody did it better.
And he was in the business for three quarters of a century, right?
Yeah. He started out at what was then known as Timely Publications. It later became Marvel Comics in 1940. And swiftly, yeah, he started out as a gopher, just sort of doing odd jobs. And then the editor-in-chief left for the competition, and he became the editor-in-chief when he was still just a teenager. For the rest of his life, he was associated with comic books, with superheroes, with what came to be known as Marvel Comics. And yeah, that multi-bajillion dollar brand was a lot to him.
Multi-bajillion is a good way of putting it.
I mean, I'm a math guy, you know, I really like to go to the numbers.
Well, so tell me a little bit more about what drew him to comics to begin. Drew, I don't mean to use, that's such a terrible pun, but what brought him to comics?
We'll forgive it.
To begin with,
it wasn't that he was a hardcore comics fan. In fact, comics had only been around in comic book form for a few years as of when he got his job at Timely. He was mainly just out looking for work. He had been, you know, an obituary writer. He'd written ad copy. He'd done a bunch of, odd writing jobs here and there. And then he had a relative who was the publisher of Timely, a guy named Martin Goodman, and he got this gig working for his relative. And he, you know, embraced the comics world, but he always had a tiny bit of disdain for it, especially early on. He often told the story of how he started using the nickname Stan Lee, the pseudonym, the nom de plume, because he was saving his real name, Stanley Lieber, for the great American novel that he was planning to write.
Aha. I'm going to jump in here because we actually have some tape of Stan Lee telling that very story. And as you said, he was born Stanley Lieberman. Here's what he told the New York Times in 2015 about why he became known instead as Stan Lee.
In those days, grown-ups hated comics, didn't want their children to read them particularly. So I figured I'm not going to use my real name, which I'm saving for posterity, for these silly comic books. So I cut my first name into two, called myself Stan Lee.
That's Stan Lee in 2015. Now, Abraham...
That familiar baritone, it's recognizable to millions. It's very sweet to hear it.
He definitely was generous in the interviews that he gave. So we've got a lot of tape of Stan Lee, and you'll hear his voice throughout the hour. But hang on here just a second, Abe, because sure. I want to bring into the conversation someone who worked with Lee in those early years. Joining us now from Queens, New York, is John Romita Sr. He worked on the amazing Spider-Man comic with Lee at Marvel in the 1960s, and he would go on to become art director at Marvel itself. John Romita Sr., welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure to be here to talk about Stan.
It's such a pleasure to have you. I'm sorry that it has to be on the occasion of Stan Lee's passing, but tell us, what was it like in those early days when you and Stan Lee first came together to do the amazing Spider-Man comics? What was he like?
It was a very interesting period. We all loved the product that we'd all put out, and there was a whole squadron of people that used to wait for Stan Lee and other editors to get a chance to get some stuff of theirs, artwork or writing and things like that. It was a very interesting time.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Romita, though, tell me, when you and Stan Lee were working together, specifically, how did that work? I mean, you were drawing these beautiful, spectacular panels telling Spider-Man's story, and then Stan would help shape the story or even what the character said. Like, tell me about that.
Well, generally was the script was first, and the artwork followed. He would lay the groundwork, and we would try and make it as interesting and as exciting as possible.
Okay, so let me just play a little bit more tape here from Stan Lee himself. In 1991, he spoke with Fresh Air's Terry Gross about why he started working in comics as a teenager, and he said that those original comics were, quote, insufferably dull. And he told Terry about, you know, say you were imagining a panel where there's a 12-foot tall, fire-breathing, two-headed purple monster walking down the street. And he said in the old days, characters would say, a creature from another world, I'd better capture him before he destroys the city.
I would like to feel that in one of our comic books, one of our heroes, such as Spider-Man, might say, who's the nut in the Halloween costume? I wonder what he's advertising. And it was just that shade of difference. I tried to do dialogue that represented the way real flesh and blood, three-dimensional people would talk and would react to things. And it came across as satire. But I wasn't trying to write humor. I was trying to be realistic. So I must be funnier than I thought.
That's Stan Lee on Fresh Air in 1991. John Romita Sr., what do you think about that? Is that the Stan Lee you know and remember?
Actually, that's what he brought into the industry. I don't think anybody else made readers feel like a part of a group and to feel among friends whenever he worked. A reader would be working on Stan stuff. There was a connection that was not done by very many people.
Yeah. Abe Reisman, jump in here. What are you hearing in John Romita's memories of Stan Lee?
Well, I'm hearing, and by the way, hello, John. Thank you for coming on here. We spoke a couple of years ago, and I'm a big fan of yours. John is hitting on something that was crucial to Stan, which was his synergy with his artists. Now, we can get into some of the disputes about who created what and exactly how much credit Stan gave the artists, but to the very end, he always talked up these people that he worked with, especially people like John and other collaborators like Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko. I remember going to a convention that he was featured at in 2015. And he just went on and on in this onstage interview about how much he loved artists like John and Jack and Steve. And, you know, again, there were disputes, but he always took time to say how much he adored the work that they did.
Yeah. Well, John Romita Sr., I want to play one more thing from Stan Lee's 1991 interview on Fresh Air, because you did work with him on the Amazing Spider-Man comic. Here's how Stan Lee described to Terry Gross how he came up with the name of his most famous superhero.
Before I came up with the name Spider-Man, I had decided I wanted a superhero who could crawl on walls, stick to the ceiling, and so forth. And I said, gee, that's a real insect power. What'll I call him? And my first thought was Insect Man, and that just didn't do it for me at all. And then I thought, well, let's see, there's Mosquito Man. That really had no appeal at all. And I went down a whole list, and when I got to Spider-Man, I mean, it was like a bell rang, a light went off above my head. Spider-Man was it. And when I put the Amazing in front of it, I knew we were home free.
I love that so much. That's Stan Lee from 1991. John Romita Sr., were you there when Stan Lee came and said, I have this new character, we're going to call him the Amazing Spider-Man?
It's amazing. The character is so grotesque and different than most superheroes that Stan had found he had included in his work this different touch. This is human beings, and his characters took a more human attitude as every day went by. He introduced something very interesting to the whole industry.
Well, John Romita Sr. worked on the Amazing Spider-Man comic with Stan Lee at Marvel in the 1960s. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Romita.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. And it was great to talk about Stan, and we miss him very badly.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break here with The Lonely Man, the theme from The Incredible Hulk. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Some music there from the 2008 film Iron Man, because this hour we're remembering Marvel Comics former editor-in-chief Stan Lee, who died this week at the age of 95. He's the man who helped bring the world Spider-Man, Thor, the X-Men, so many of the most popular and enduring characters from the entire Marvel universe. And we want to hear from you. Who's your favorite Marvel Comics character? How did that character help change your life or affect your life? And could you imagine Marvel without Stan Lee, especially the Marvel of today, that billion-dollar juggernaut that seems to have totally taken over Hollywood? I'm joined today by Abraham Reisman. He's staff writer at New York Magazine and at Vulture. And Abe, I want to actually read you some comments that have come online here for us. There's a theme. A bunch of people saying, for example, NX74205, whoever you are, thank you for your most creative
rolls off the tongue
screen handle. But NX says, one of the big things that differentiates between Marvel and DC is that Marvel characters are flawed and have problems that don't go away with their powers. Peter Parker's problems got more complicated when he becomes Spider-Man, not easier. And then Jason Turner echoes that and says, loved Spider-Man as a kid? Somehow Stan Lee tapped directly into the kind of angst that would resonate with a preteen. The DC stable of superheroes was boring by comparison. So talk to that. Was Stan Lee one of the first to do that?
Yes, I do want to make sure that we give a lot of credit to Stan's co-creator of Spider-Man, a man named Steve Ditko, who died a few months ago, really a tremendous creator in his own right. He was the artist, but also the co-writer of those stories. It's a bit complicated to describe the exact writing process, but the artists had a tremendous amount of input on them. And these stories really did capture teen angst in a way that superhero comics had never tried before. And that was due to Stan, but it was also due to Steve. And the two of them really created this character who could be at once extremely buoyant and funny and witty and have cultural references and slang, which was another set of things that superhero characters hadn't really tried before. But then also, you know, slip into these dark places where he was trying to get his life together. He was struggling with all of his problems. That was revolutionary for the time. It's become almost de rigueur now, but no one had really attempted that as of 1962.
Huh. Well, we have a clip here from Stan Lee's TV talk show pilot, one that he made in 1968. Marvel just released a video on Tuesday. This clip is in that video, in memory of Lee.
I'm Stan Lee. I've been writing stories for the young generation for the past 30 years. During this time, I think I've learned a lot about what young people think. More importantly, I think I've learned a lot about what young people are. We're going to try to present a voice that somebody will listen to. The voice is needed. We hope it will be ours.
That's from 1968, a talk show pilot that Stan Lee recorded. Let's get a quick call here. Mike is calling from Lincoln, Nebraska. Mike, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Mike.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. Go ahead.
Oh, there we go. Great. Here in Nebraska. And first to start off with, I just want you to know that when I was a kid, my very first introduction with Marvel was through the Fantastic Four. It was my favorite and still is. But I've got an interesting array of connections with Stan Lee and those with what's going on in California right now, particularly around Thousand Oaks. That's where Jack Kirby lived. And which I did not know at the time. I wish I had, because I would have been over scratching on his door. But, and my uncle had a mortuary business, and they buried Jack Kirby. So it's like one thing just leads to another. And my love of Stan and everyone's work is just... it's eternal.
Yeah.
Always, always love, what Marvel has brought to us. And I keep talking with friends and we say, did you ever imagine a day when we could see our superheroes in comic books or our heroes in comic books come to life on the screen?
Yeah. Well, Mike, thank you so much for your call. Abe Reisman, Mike's call lets us kind of explore two other aspects or mm-hmm. two of the more important aspects of Stan Lee's legacy. First of all, let's talk about the Marvel on screen, right? Because I think, I will be honest with all listeners now. I'm not a huge comic book fan myself, uh-huh. but I've seen
It's fine, them, not for everybody.
I have seen like the many, many tens or hundreds of millions of people around the world have seen the entire universe, the movies now that have come out of the Marvel mm-hmm. universe. I mean, should we be thinking of Stan Lee's legacy now more as the man who helped put Marvel on screen versus the man, who helped create the catalog that has become the Marvel Universe in the comics?
I think we should err on the side of thinking about him more as the man who co-created the universe in the comics. But he certainly tried very hard while he was still working at Marvel to get these stories onto the big screen. He was a big movie buff, and in 1980 he moved to Hollywood with largely the intention of trying to get Marvel characters made into movies. And it didn't really work out when he was trying it. Maybe the culture wasn't ready. Maybe special effects weren't ready. You can point to any number of factors. But only really after Stan kind of got out of that game and was no longer doing active duty at Marvel did the movies really start to blow up. And that doesn't mean, though, that he didn't have some influence. I mean, without him and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, we just wouldn't have these characters, and we wouldn't be seeing them on the big screen.
Right. But so speaking of Kirby, you wrote extensively, though, about how even though Stan Lee and Jack Kirby worked together so closely for so long, there was a huge fracture between them. And that's part of the more complicated aspect of Stan Lee's legacy.
Yes, there was this real rift between Stan and Jack. They were very different people. Stan was a showman, and he was light and bubbly and talkative. Jack was much more of a quiet, reserved, somewhat withdrawn man. And they ended up having differences over who created the characters that they worked on together and how Jack was created. I'm sorry, was credited. And it gets very murky, but basically Jack, before he died in 1994, claimed that almost every Marvel character was originally his idea, and Stan was just writing, you know, dialogue and narration for these stories that he was coming up with, that he, Jack, was coming up with. And Stan, of course, disputed that account and maintained that the ideas were primarily his, and he just gave the ideas to artists like Jack, who would then come up with visuals for them. And, you know, they were co-writing these stories because they used this writing method called the Marvel method, where Stan and his artistic collaborators would come up with a loose outline for a plot together, and then the artist would go and actually hammer out the story in drawn form and then bring it back to Stan, who would then do dialogue and narration. So by any reasonable definition, these were co-writers, but he was really just billing them most of the time as artists. And that was something that was deeply frustrating for Jack. So by the end of Jack's life, he really had a lot of resentment for Stan, which is very sad.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So then there's another aspect of who Lee was and his legacy. We have a listener on Twitter, Kathleen Hornby, saying, "Hey, On Point, are you going to mention the many sexual assault and harassment claims against Stan Lee?"
Yes. Around the end of his life, there were allegations of sexual misconduct involving a masseuse. I won't get into the lurid details, but it is, you know, a very serious allegation. And I don't have any evidence one way or the other about what happened. There are allegations that the allegations were made up because there was a lot of legal wrangling and personal wrangling going on in Stan's life around the end. There were actors in his life, you know, a former manager, his daughter, people who were really kind of fighting over Stan and his legacy. And, you know, there have been people who have said that the allegations were made up in an attempt to, you know, influence those issues. But it's very much worth mentioning. Yes, that's something we should take seriously and that should continue to be looked into.
Yeah. Well, Kathleen Hornby on Twitter, thanks so much for mentioning that. And I'm glad we touched on it. But let's turn now to Kurt, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Kurt, you're on the air. Kurt, you with us? Okay, looks like we don't have Kurt. Let's go to Rob, who's calling from Mamaroneck, New York. Rob, you're on the air.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, Rob.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I have an unusual Stan Lee story. The year was 1976 or 1977, and I was a young account executive at Edelman Public Relations, and our account, which I was the account executive on, was Ovaltine. And Ovaltine had always positioned itself as a healthy alternative to chocolate mixed drinks and what have you. And it also happened to be the year that Annie was the big Broadway hit. Now, all this is relative because in the 30s and 40s, Ovaltine used to give away little prizes in their with their product that were based on superheroes and also Little Orphan Annie. So there were magic rings and watches and what have you. And my boss at the time came up with this idea, let's create a superhero comic book, which was also an activity book to encourage physical fitness and healthy lifestyles.
Yeah.
And of course, it was targeted at children. And Stan Lee was the person we hired to put together the book. And I remember
no kidding.
Him walking into our office. And I was, like I said, brand new to the industry, didn't really know who Stan Lee was. But it was a great experience. And I, as I was telling your screener, I just hope I still have a copy of that book someplace.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for your call. I just want to bring in, while we can, one more voice into this conversation. Joe Quesada joins us now from New York. He's Chief Creative Officer of Marvel Entertainment and former Editor-in-Chief of Marvel, and was the longest-serving editor at Marvel other than Stan Lee. Joe Quesada, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Megan. Thank you for having me.
It's really great for you to be able to join us today, and I'm very appreciative of it. How is Marvel reacting to the passing, to the death of Stan Lee?
You know, it's as you expect. It's been a pretty somber few days for us because, you know, at 95, Stan lived an amazing life, a glorious life. He lived it to the fullest, and even though you know we all sense that this day would eventually come, you're never quite. Well, it's not unexpected. You're never quite ready for the feeling of that vacuum that's left behind. There's a big hole in Marvel's heart right now that's going to take some time for us to, you know, really kind of get past. It's been rough, but, you know, at the same time, you know, Stan was such a jovial guy, just self-deprecating guy that at the same time we could sit around and tell Stan stories and cheer ourselves up. And we know that Stan would more than likely really had appreciated that's what we're doing.
Well, so what impact did he have on your life directly?
You know, I've told this story once or twice. A couple of years ago, I was at a convention with Stan, and I was doing a panel, then he was doing a panel, and they'd asked me to come on the panel just to surprise Stan and say, hey, how you doing, Stan? You know, shake his hand, and we've known each other for years, just to, you know, get the crowd a bit in a frenzy. So I went up there and I shook his hand, and I guess I said it loud enough that the mic caught it, but I said to him, I said, listen, I love you, and you saved my life. And by that, I don't mean that, you know, I was a suicidal kid or anything like that, but there's a direct line between the very first comic book I read, which was a Stan Lee book, to where I ended up in life, which was eventually sitting in Stan's chair and being a part of Marvel. My life, I don't know what my life would be like if I hadn't read that book, if I hadn't been introduced to the works of Stan Lee and his co-creators.
Well, so can I ask you, let me just jump in here. What was that first book that you read?
That first book I read was, I believe, Spider-Man. It was 97 or 98. My dad had bought it for me. If you can indulge me in this quick story, I'll tell you, because it's my dad had heard of this guy Stan Lee on the news. My dad didn't know from Spider-Man or anything like that, but he'd heard of this guy Stan Lee on the news, who had written this book, comic book, about the evils of drug addiction, and he thought, as dads would be prone to do, what a great way to teach my 8-year-old son about the evils of drug addiction than through this comic book. So he took me in hand to the candy store where we picked up this issue of Spider-Man, and then I picked up the next one and the next one. And you know what? He was 1,000% right. I never got addicted to drugs, but I got addicted to something that probably cost him a lot more money in the long run, which was Marvel Comics. It was Stan. And by the way, the reason that Stan was on the news was because he had rebuked the Comics Code Authority, which is sort of like the good housekeeping seal of approval of comics back in the day. It was a self-censorship group. And they refused to sanction this book because even though it was an anti-drug, it mentioned drugs. And Stan sort of just flipped in the middle finger and said, I'm going to do this anyway, because he also had the blessing of the U.S. government for this. So that made mainstream news, and that's how my father caught it. But that was Stan's magic, right? His magic was getting that press, getting that news, and all the time, the messages within the books were just the most amazing morality plays and stories about you know, social change, social justice, diversity. He was just so ahead of his time.
Joe, I'm going to jump in here because I have to take Joe. Forgive me for interrupting. Sure. You have to take a quick break. But let me ask you: can you stick with us for a few more minutes after the break?
Absolutely. No worries.
Okay, great. So you're listening to Joe Quesada. He's Chief Creative Officer of Marvel Entertainment. Abraham Reisman is also with us. He's staff writer at New York Magazine and at Vulture. And we're remembering Stan Lee, former editor-in-chief of Marvel, this hour. What's your memory of your favorite Stan Lee comics? And now even, you know, what do you make of Marvel, the incredible Hollywood juggernaut in the movies? We'll take a quick break here, listening to the Doctor Strange theme. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're remembering Stan Lee this hour. He is the former editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics. He died this week at the age of 95. You're listening there to the theme from Black Panther. That's the latest of the characters from the Marvel Universe to make it onto the big screen. Now, since 2008, Marvel has produced more than 20 films that have grossed more than $17 billion worldwide, and Stan Lee had cameos in all of them. So here are a few memorable scenes from his movies and television, by the way. So we've got some scenes here from the Amazing Spider-Man TV series, from Thor: The Dark World, and from Captain America: Civil War, and from Spider-Man 2.
I'm looking for some guy named Stan Lee.
What? Spider-Man?
Any questions?
Yeah, can I have my shoe back?
Are you Tony Stank?
Yes, this is Tony Stank.
You know, I guess one person can make a difference. Enough said.
It's a little montage there of some of the cameo appearances that Stan Lee has made in the Marvel Universe on screen. Joe Quesada is with us this hour. He's Chief Creative Officer of Marvel Entertainment. And Joe, I know I've got to let you go here in a minute or two, but I want to run something by you here. The Daily Beast is saying that in part because of Disney's acquisition of Marvel in 2009 for $4 billion, the Daily Beast says that among the people who shaped the legacy of Disney as a company, Lee is probably second only to Walt Disney himself. What do you think of that?
I agree with that 100%. You know, and one of the things I was going to state before was that losing Stan is on par with losing Walt. That kind of creative genius, that kind of a creative force, that kind of a persona, you don't see people like that come around very often. So it's just a great loss, not just to Marvel, not just to Disney, but just the world in general. He has shaped popular culture. There's no doubt about it, from his ideas to his creations to his persona.
So before you leave us, do you have one final memory or story of Stan you'd like to share?
You know, I have so many stories. The one thing I could tell you just from a personal point of view is that there are so many people that we meet in life, you know, and you know, whether they're a celebrity or a person that you've sort of admired for many, many years. And so often when you meet that person, it's like, oh, I see, that was just sort of a persona. That's not the person who I thought they were. And in some cases, they could be disappointing, or you could be disappointed. Stan was exactly who me personally, as a kid reading his soapboxes, which were these little sort of editorial blurbs that he would do about 150 to 200 words once a week in all the comics, where he would talk to the readers. And you literally felt like he was talking to you personally, not realizing that the kid standing next to you was feeling the exact same thing. But I had a vision in my mind of what Stan looked like, what he sounded like, what he would be like if I ever had the opportunity to meet him. I was fortunate enough in my lifetime that not only did I meet him, but we became very, very good friends, and he became a mentor to me. And from the very first moment that I met him and he shook my hand, he said, "Joey," and he put his hand on my shoulder, he was everything that 8-year-old me thought he would be. And he never stopped being that guy up until, you know, the last time I saw him.
Well, Joe Quesada is Chief Creative Officer for Marvel Entertainment, also former Editor-in-Chief of Marvel, the longest-serving editor other than Stan Lee, joining us today from New York. Joe Quesada, thank you so very much.
Lena, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, Abraham Reisman is also with us. He's staff writer at New York Magazine and at Vulture as well. And Abe, I'm going to presume that you wish you could have asked Joe a lot of questions, but I had to let him go there. He stepped away from what he was working on.
Genius in his own right. I've interviewed him a couple of times.
And yeah, Marvel is very, very busy these days. What's your thought there on the question that I posed to Joe about that Stan Lee stands second only to Disney in terms of the impact on shaping the Walt Disney Company itself?
Yeah, I mean, I am completely in agreement. You know, he wasn't always a Disney guy. Obviously, the acquisition only happened a few years ago, but once that acquisition happened, all of a sudden, Disney had access to these properties that were, you know, pretty well known then. But thanks to the advent of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, those characters are now about as famous as anything Walt Disney ever came up with. I mean, just think about Spider-Man, who technically the Spider-Man film rights are owned by Sony. I'm pushing my glasses up on my nose like a nerd. But but he's part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which Disney controls. I mean, Spider-Man as a visual and as a concept is about as ubiquitous as Mickey Mouse. I mean, you go anywhere in the world, you're going to find people wearing Spider-Man t-shirts, even if they've never read a Spider-Man comic. So I would certainly put him up there with Disney when it comes to his influence on the Disney brand and just on popular culture in general.
You know, I mean, first of all, nerdiness is embraced on this program, absolutely. And I, too, am pushing up my glasses here. But you know, so if we're talking about Stan Lee's legacy, I would think that some people, even though they might enjoy the Marvel films, you know, the whole universe, and universe is really key to what we're looking at in terms of Marvel's impact on popular culture today. There are a lot of folks out there who say, oh, on the other hand, that, you know, $17 billion in revenues for Marvel films is what's wrecking Hollywood, right? Because you can't get a big film made unless it's got some tie-in, or maybe you can, but it's easier to get a big film made if it's got some tie-in to the Marvel universe, and it's making all other sorts of filmmaking tougher in Hollywood.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. Everyone's mileage may vary on how much they actually enjoy the, you know, hegemony that Marvel has at the box office. I mean, there is no single brand, possibly with the exception of Star Wars, that has the kind of clutch on the global imagination that Marvel does. And that has manifested itself in kind of a crowding out at the box office. You have, you know, you'll have up to like half a dozen Marvel adaptations on big screens in a given year. And, you know, those are slots that are not being taken up by things that are not adaptations and sequels and franchise builders. And, you know, it's up to the individual viewer to decide whether or not it's worth it to just have their beloved superheroes get so much screen time. But it certainly does appear that a lot of people feel that way. So, you know, for film buffs, it might be irritating, but for the average fanboy, fangirl, fan person, it's still pretty delightful.
Well, let's go to some of those fanboys, fangirls. Let's roll through a bunch of them here because we got a lot on the line. Chief is calling us from Waterbury, Connecticut. Chief, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Stan Lee stands out as like a super icon for me because, you know, in the early 70s, you know, coming out of adoption, finding out at an early age, you know, that I was adopted and, you know, being scared to death, I became enthralled from the Spider-Man comic book when I first saw it, and I started reading. I was struggling in school, you know, in my early years, and especially with reading. But as I started to, you know, absorb the comic books, my reading comprehension, spelling everything, I ended up progressing to like 2 or 3 grades ahead.
Wow.
In school.
Wow.
So yeah. Yeah, Spider-Man, you know, icon. It's because of the comic books that I am who I am today to some degree.
Wow, Chief, thank you so much for your call. We're hearing that a lot from fans of Stan Lee's work this hour. Let's go to Russell, who's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Russell, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's your thought today?
My thoughts are I was pretty much crushed when I went to the newsstand and saw that Stan Lee died. And I grew up reading Spider-Man, and I'm an artist for a living. And the illustrations were so great, and the perspective. It taught me perspective. It taught me human anatomy. I went on to become a great, I'll say great artist. It got me, I won art competitions because of imitating and drawing a human figure. And I also was able to be a medical illustration hustle for a minute. And then, to make a long story short, I wound up in the film business in New York City.
Yeah.
And I worked in a lot of movies as a scenic artist, scenic designer.
Russell, I wish that we had got your call in earlier in this hour because we had John Romita Sr. on, who was the art director at Marvel and worked with Stan Lee doing the artwork for Spider-Man. So I'm sorry we didn't get to you sooner. But thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Kevin, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that Stan Lee, there were about 7 of us growing up in Queens, and he was the binding. He was the thing that bound our friendship to this day, 40 years later. And he also dealt with a lot of the isms in this society. You know, you were getting a lot of social lessons at a really young age. My favorite Marvel book is a graphic novel called God Loves, Man Kills. I really hope they republish that. I think one of Marvel's greatest works,
yeah,
still to this day.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for your call. Abe Reisman, this is something that came up with Joe Quesada as well about the themes that Stan Lee's comics engaged with. Talk to me more about that.
Well, Stan always used to say that when he and his collaborators co-created the Marvel Universe, what he really wanted to do was create heroes with feet of clay, as he put it. He wanted these to be human, three-dimensional, grounded figures. And although you go back and read the comics today and it seems a little flashy and cartoony, at the time it was a big quantum leap forward from the rather dull, stoic depictions of superheroes that had been predominant prior to that. And in order to make these heroes relatable and interesting, he often had them confront real world problems. Mm-hmm. So, you know, racism and bigotry was something that Stan throughout his life felt was despicable and wanted to push back against. And so you'd have these stories where characters would be, you know, fighting against, you know, the hate monger was a character that sometimes popped up, you know, people who their whole deal was that they were racist, they were prejudiced. And it was the job of the heroes to demonstrate to these young readers that those were qualities that you should try to avoid in your conduct as a person.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was very important for Stan.
Let's go to Bob, who's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Bob, you're on the air.
Hello, everyone. I just wanted to say that as a child, I really thank Stan Lee because he helped me reading the Hulk comic books. My dad was in Vietnam when I was born, and he came back with like a post-traumatic stress disorder, and it was really hard on my family. And I read those comic books, and I can tell you they made a huge difference in my life, because men and women that serve have some of the Hulk in them, and kids need to relate to those books, and I did. And I just wanted to say that I really, really appreciated his artistic ability and his contribution to me as a child dealing with my father.
Yeah, Bob, don't hang up yet.
From the military.
Yeah, can I just ask you a question? So take us back to when you first read those Hulk comics. I mean, what did you see in that story, in those stories, that specifically helped you understand your father better?
Well, it was the imperfection, the fact that you could have somebody that had Banner and have a side of a scientist and have a great mind, which my father did. He had a master's degree from the University of Alabama, very accomplished in the military. And he's passed now, but when he came back from war, he was in the Gulf War in Vietnam, and he had a side of him that was a struggle. And that's what Stan captured for me as a child, is that it was okay to have that struggle. And it kind of brought that something I could understand or relate to as a kid, and I related it to my dad. So I just wanted to say that he would be missed, and thanks to Marvel for bringing it to fruition.
It sounds like it made a huge difference in your life, Bob. I mean, you're even feeling it to this day.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Bob, thank you so much for your call. Abe Reisman, I mean, you know, it's easy to think of comics as this fun thing that kids, you know, read and share when they're younger, like the lark, part of the lark of childhood. But obviously, we've been hearing from callers that they're anything but, or at least Stan Lee's comics are anything but that.
Well, they certainly had a lot of impact on young readers. And, you know, those are things that get instilled in you at a young age that you hold on to when you're an adult. But even beyond that, he had an impact on adults because these archetypes that he created were so durable and so adaptable that later creators who were writing for an even more mature audience than the one that Stan was envisioning when he was writing his stuff, those creators were able to play around with, you know, your Spider-Mans and your Hulks and your X-Men and make them into something that adults could relate to, and not just on a level of nostalgia and childhood impact. And yeah, it's a real testament to the power of these archetypes.
Well, I want to end this hour with one last note from Stan Lee himself, because he not that long ago gave an interview with WBUR Shira Springer just last summer, and he talked about how the very first publisher he worked with only cared about creating comics that had two characters fighting, and that there was no focus on backstory or the character's own inner lives. And this is a clip where Stan Lee gives a tip of a hat to his wife, Joan, because he said he was so frustrated he wanted to quit, but it was Joan who changed everything.
One day I came home and I said to my wife, honey, I'm going to quit. It's ridiculous. I've got to get a better job somewhere else. And she gave me the wisest advice, the turning point in my life. She said, Stan, why don't you do a story the way you'd want to do it? You want to quit anyway, so if he fires you, so what? But at least you'll get it off your chest.
Well, thank you, Joan, because after that came Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, and as Stan Lee himself said, the rest is history. Abraham Reisman, staff writer at New York Magazine and at Vulture, thank you so very much for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
We'll go out with the Avengers theme. I'm Meghna Chakraborty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title, and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.